organizes major political, economic, cultural, and social events concerning Iran. So don't miss the opportunity to listen to Iran Today on IRIB English Radio.
More coming up, but first a quick diversion to see what other media outlets have to say.
Here's how it looks on the page. Tasnim News points to SCOs taking notice of Iran's importance. SCO chief highlights Iran's role in international security, it reads. In a meeting with Iranian President Ebrahim Raisi held in Uzbekistan, Samarkand, SCO Secretary General Zhang Ming hailed Iran as a great and influential country that can play a significant role in regional and international security. Known as a major country in the region, Iran also holds close political and trade relations with the SCO members by relying on its broad historical and civilizational commonalities with the regional countries, Zhang Ming added, pointing to the arrangements made by the SCO Secretariat for Iran's membership in the SCO. The Chinese diplomat said he and Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdullahian have signed the Memorandum of Commitments allowing Iran to join the organization. France 24 quotes how Saudi Arabia is finally reciprocating Iran's look to strengthening relations with neighbors. We intend to build a positive relationship with our neighbors in Iran, Saudi FM says. In an interview with France 24 on the sidelines of the UN General Assembly in New York, Saudi Arabia's foreign minister said that his country had concerns about a possible revived nuclear deal between Western powers and Iran, especially over IAEA inspections. However, Prince Faisal bin Farhan Al Saud said that even a flawed deal was better than no deal. He said there were still differences with Iran that currently precluded him meeting with his Iranian counterpart, but said we certainly have the intent to build a positive relationship with our neighbors in Iran. ORF Online sounds bluntly realistic. Iran's SCO accession, a timely yet insufficient gambit. The changing world order has opened the doors of the Shanghai Cooperation Organization to Iran, but whether it will prove useful to the country is yet to be seen. Although the rising anti-Western narratives amongst the key SCO members manifest themselves differently in policy terms, Tehran's long-standing revisionism is set to drive Iran, Russia, and China relatively closer together in geopolitical and strategic matters. Iran's leader Ayatollah Khamenei supports Raisi's Eastern policy, saying, "One of our priorities today in foreign policy is preferring the East to the West, neighbors to remote countries." As a part of its pivot to East policy, Iran seeks to play an active role in the shifting global order, thanks to its geostrategic position in the new geopolitical environment. And that'll be it for the news section. Do stay tuned. With its maximum pressure sanctions on Iran, Trump's USA had tried to bring this country's oil exports down to zero. Although sanctions did make a good dent in our oil revenues, that wicked plan didn't quite pull off. China and India have their more urgent needs than the necessity of appeasing the US with its secondary sanctions. And China, a dangerous rival to US trade, has suffered and had to find a way around US sanctions anyway. Now, with Iran's SCO accession, things can only get better, optimism aside.
There are three requirements before we can reach our economy, cultural, tourism, environment, investment, and banking potentials of this alliance. The first requirement is the assessment and introduction of laws that are needed to join the SCO by Iran, which will definitely be time-consuming. The second requirement is creating technical and logistic infrastructure to be able to use the potentials of the SCO in the competitive market that will be created for Iranian firms. Joining this organization is certainly a great exercise for the future of Iran, so that it can join the World Trade Organization. the third requirement for Iran in order to invite and host the companies and investors from SCO members is solving our issues of sanctions to be present in the main tier of the organization.
Some points top of the agenda to facilitate dealings without a shadow of the U.S. with its dollar and control over banks is the removal of the U.S. dollar and the euro. Iran even offered to the other sides the use of insurance and new financial channels that its central bank has in mind. Alireza Peymanpak, head of TPOI, confirmed this, TPOI being the trade promotion organization of Iran. He also said, in the field of customs, similar to the agreement signed between the three countries of Iran, Azerbaijan and Russia a few months ago, negotiations have also been conducted with other countries. All these measures will lead to the development of trade and the creation of stable income for the Islamic Republic.
Every year, first the heads of states and then the ministers of foreign affairs of SCO member states should be able to come up with creative measures regarding economy, cultural, transportation, and logistics matters. They should be able to use these creative measures and international agreements with various other organizations to increase the economic development under sustainable economic policies and take a viable step for all member states.
The level of trade between Iran and its potential 25-year all-round partner China is that Iran-China bilateral trade witnessed an increase of 19% in the first 8 months of this year, hitting over $11 billion. Iran's exports to China in the first 8 months of 2022 increased by 14% compared to the same period last year and reached under $5 billion. Iran's imports from China between January and August of the current year also witnessed an increase of 24%, which brought imports up to over $6 billion. China exported $5 billion worth of goods to Iran between January and August of last year. In August, China exported $1.1 billion worth of goods to Iran and imported $476 million worth of goods from this country. China's exports to Iran have increased by 36% this month, but the country's imports from Iran have decreased by 33% compared to August of 2021. Although on such a grand scale, the importance of supervision over implementation and capital and income is paramount. A source in the Ministry of Roads announced that Iran is making efforts to launch a direct train from China to Iran, and the capacity for trade between member states will increase as transportation and transit grow.
When you are invited to the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and you accept the invitation, the role that you'll have in the SCO is not defined by other nations. It's your business. If the Islamic Republic has a well-planned strategy, it can find exactly what role it can play in this puzzle and use the potentials of the organization. We see China, Russia, and others do that. Central Asian countries are using this very well. Keep in mind that in all other international organizations, even the United Nations, they give you a seat. But what you do with that seat is entirely up to you. You can either do nothing and sit idle, or you can seek for new opportunities and use them.
Every two or few states may decide on their own bilateral or multilateral relations and agreements. But those are influenced by each state's relations with third parties. And in a club, each member can have an impact on ambiance and affairs ongoing. One of the decisions reached at the recent Samarkand-Uzbekistan summit was to begin the process of including Bahrain, the Maldives, the UAE, Kuwait and Myanmar as new dialogue partners. Qatar, Saudi Arabia and Egypt signed MOUs and were granted the status of SCO dialogue partners. It would seem the East is setting up a front before and against the West, but our analysts say not.
Would you say the Shanghai Cooperation has created a front before Western alliances?
The Islamic Republic of Iran, according to its own principles, is not seeking to participate a certain bloc or oppose another. Even in the context of our look east and Asia-oriented policy, especially in the era of the new administration, the 13th administration, their approach is not creating a conflict or joining an axis to oppose another. It's seeking balanced relations in the sense that it will use all the existing capacities and opportunities in order to realize and protect the interests of the Islamic Republic of Iran, especially in terms of economy.
The SCO, a regional forum promoting regionalism and a win-win opportunity for Eurasian members, was launched to combat the three evils: terrorism, separatism, and extremism. After signing a multidimensional 25-year strategic treaty with China and preparing to make a similar deal with Russia in the near term, Iran's accession to the SCO could be seen as the third decisive move in this country's deep inclination towards the East.
The presence of China as the founder of the Belt and Road Initiative and the presence of Iran that created the North-South Corridor and the fact that member states can access them can make their roles much more significant. Central Asian countries, and especially India, can utilize this and connect to the Indian Ocean from Iran to St. Petersburg and then Europe. Central Asian countries can utilize the North-South Corridor, which can be impactful in the SCO.
The Belt and Road, as it is called, isn't in essence about the road. We know what a road does. It connects point A to point B. But in the SCO, we don't talk about roads. It is more like a corridor. I mean, in a corridor, in addition to connecting point A to point B, there are events that take place in the distance between these points. What I mean is that the distance between A and B will experience development.
Just one thing. I wondered how far the security alliance, the SCO, would go to help us in dealing with security problems occasionally arising. Would it be profit or potential help? Because any benefits from deals and clubs can only follow security and stability.
Why don't you scrub out propagandist rumors for us? I think going by honesty is the best policy. The real picture should be a better picture of the Shanghai Cooperation.
There is a concept called the spirit of the SCO, on which the Chinese and Russians insist. They must be carefully studied by other countries as well. When we study the spirit of the SCO, we see the issue of convergence and multilateralism is insisted upon. It's interesting to know that a motto of the SCO, which must be focused on in Iran, is non-aligned participation and cooperation. It's very important because we need to be realistic when we consider membership in the SCO. We can't say it'll solve everything like a fantasy. The principle of non-alignment convergence. What is that? It's the same as the Organization of Non-Aligned Nations. They said we are allies and we have converged, but there are no alignments with other countries. We should know that, for example, if we are members of the SCO and a war takes place in a member state, none of the member states are obliged to give military aid to that state. This is non-aligned convergence, as we see Russia is at war, but none of the Shanghai member states have an obligation to go and help Russia. This is the difference between SCO and NATO.
That'll be it for today. Thanks from the whole team. Bye for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Puerto Rico is suffering from the consequences of another major hurricane. Hurricane Fiona brings the experiences of the past with itself. Weak infrastructure, discrimination, and inequality in Puerto Rico. Stay tuned for the first part, please. In this regard, the website of Axios wrote, Puerto Ricans are scrambling to figure out how or whether to rebuild after yet another major disaster. There are some issues, including a state of play. About 33% of homes and businesses were still without power recently, more than a week after Hurricane Fiona hit, according to Luma Energy, the island's grid operator. Thousands still don't have running water. Some roads remain blocked by flooding and rock slides, leaving several communities in the south isolated, without access to supplies. Driving the news, while Fiona, a Category 1 hurricane when it made landfall, was considerably weaker than 2017's hurricanes Maria and Irma, both Category 5 storms, its devastation is expected to compound the already strained recovery efforts from the past disasters. Estimates put the damages of Hurricane Maria at $100 billion. About $28 billion in federal funds had been earmarked for recovery projects at the beginning of August. Many homes destroyed by Maria and the island's power grid were still being rebuilt when Fiona hit. Plus, the pandemic hit Puerto Rico's economy especially hard. More than 40% of the island's population lived below the poverty line last year, according to census data. For small business owners, the cascade of disasters on top of the island's long-standing bankruptcy issues has made even the thought of rebuilding again hard to bear. This is the fifth time everything floods, the fifth time I lose it. Carmelo Varquez Rivera, who owns a TV and electronics repair shop, told Noticias Telemundo after Fiona hit, adding, I've started back up before, but this time I just don't have the strength. The big picture. A U.S. Congress-established financial oversight board nicknamed La Junta remains mostly in charge of the island's budget. La Junta has been criticized by some lawmakers who argue the board's austerity measures after Hurricane Maria made recovery harder.
La Junta agreed to release up to $250,000 to each of Puerto Rico's 78 municipalities for Fiona's recovery. President Biden also approved a major disaster declaration for the island and ordered federal aid to assist with recovery efforts. But many worry the money and declaration won't be enough, especially for an island with a history of corruption, delays in aid distribution, and budgetary mismanagement. Others have taken authorities to task for not enacting more programs that could make the island more resilient. There should have been more investments in weather-resistant designs of roads and the grid line. Martha Quinones, professor at the Universidad de Puerto Rico, told El Nuevo Día. Puerto Rican authorities in 2019 set a goal of transitioning to renewable power by 2050, which would help more people weather the storms by having a grid that doesn't get as easily knocked down by winds and rain. But as of February, about 3% of the island's electricity comes from renewables, mostly pushed by NGOs working with solar power. There is also a concern that the island will continue to experience the brain drain that worsened after Hurricanes Maria and Irma. The island saw an 11.8% drop in its population between 2010 and 2020, according to census data. Part of that is due to the island's struggling economy made worse by crisis after crisis. Many people who have remained on the island have been pushed out of their homes by land developers and cryptocurrency investors who have bought out apartment buildings and other properties, making rents soar and prompting more Puerto Ricans to leave for the mainland U.S. The bottom line, the island was still years away from fully recovering from Maria and Irma when Fiona hit. Those recovery efforts are expected to take longer now, leaving many Puerto Ricans fearing for when the next disaster may strike. Politico also writes, "What up, Rickcast family? President Joe Biden declares the pandemic is over and questions arise over weather. Florida Governor Ron DeSantis had the budget authority to fly migrants to Martha's Vineyard. Plus, Adnan Said, whose case inspired the Migate podcast serial, is freed from prison. First, though, we focus on the latest unfolding in Puerto Rico. The latest collapse of Puerto Rico's power grid after it was thrashed by Hurricane Fiona over the weekend was a foreseeable crisis that activists, including Puerto Rican Bunny, have been working to prevent a crisis deeply rooted in the island's status as a U.S. territory. Turn back the calendar to 5 years ago today. Hurricane Maria, coming less than 2 weeks after Hurricane Irma, was the strongest hurricane to hit the island in nearly a century. The website of Politico wrote, Maria, a category 4 storm that caused an estimated 2,975 deaths, decimated Puerto Rico's power, water, healthcare systems. The island has never truly recovered from that blow. In those intervening years, those living on the island have had to endure multiple crises, including earthquakes that further destabilized the power grid, not to mention the COVID-19 pandemic. With Fiona, the island suffered yet another total blackout when the then Category 1 storm knocked out power to 1.5 million customers, dumped some 32 inches of rain on some parts of the island, and triggered catastrophic flooding and widespread loss of water service.
All we say to America is be true to what you said on paper.
We won't back down.
Stop the witch hunt.
Turn here now.
We will resist.
I can't breathe. Help me. Please.
We the people.
Believe it or not, water is scarce. Two of the largest reservoirs in America, providing water and electricity to millions of people, are reaching dead pool status. The U.S. states face more mandatory water cuts due to extreme drought. Now, these cuts mostly affect the states of Arizona and Nevada. And also, more than 150,000 people in Mississippi's capital had no clean running water for weeks. People had to stand in line for hours just to get bottled water. Jackson, a predominantly black populated city, has been facing water issues for years now. Now, while the country is in dire need of investment in infrastructure, the government is still keen on increasing military spending.
Muddy waters.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to We the People. I am your host, Daniel Arya. In today's episode, we discuss the country's water crisis, how lakes and rivers are drying up, and people are faced with some serious water cuts. The water crisis in Jackson, where people have gone without clean water for weeks now, and how racism plays an important role in the problems of the capital there of Mississippi. As usual, we're pleased to have our two guests on our show, Tom Michalak, political analyst from Detroit, Michigan, and Dan Poole-Jew from the Pacific Green Party, who's running for election in the U.S. Senate from Oregon. Stay tuned.
Droughts and water crisis in the world has not spared Americans. Coupled with mismanagement, old and depleted infrastructure, millions of Americans are facing a crisis. The predominantly African-American populated city of Jackson, Mississippi, had no clean running water for weeks. Hours-long lines to receive bottled water exhausted the population. At some point, the city ran out of bottled water and issued warnings to boil tap water before use. If people were lucky to have tap water, the liquid running from taps looked like anything but water. A brown, muddy liquid ran through the taps, and at some places, people reported a stench of sewage coming from the water.
Around 150,000 people are being forced to buy water or rely on bottled water pickup sites for something to drink and just to brush their teeth. The city has been under a boil water advisory since the end of July after pumps were damaged at their water treatment plant. The plant failed last Monday. Right now, FEMA is working to increase the water pressure, but the mayor says it could be days or even weeks before the water is safe to drink.
Now, in early 2020, Jackson's water system failed an inspection by the Environmental Protection Agency. The agency found that there was harmful bacteria or parasites present in the drinking water. In the winter of 2021 storm, pipes froze and burst, and the people went without water for over a month. July of 2022 was the start of another crisis with the city's water plant damaged. Please explain the water crisis we're seeing today in America.
Across the United States, there have for many years been reported issues of water, whether it be the quality of the water, whether it be access to water. As people may recall, in 2013-14, where I live in Detroit, there was an international story about widespread water shutoffs for residents who owe outstanding water bills. And of course, at the same time, there was the Flint water crisis, which is ongoing, which was a matter of water that wasn't suitable for human consumption, leading to illness and death in many cases. So, and of course, there's been stories of water quality being affected by fracking in states like Pennsylvania and others where that takes place. A lot of videos went viral online of people literally lighting the water coming out of their tap on fire, indicating, well, water that's not suitable to be drank. So this is an ongoing crisis, water in the United States.
Imagine that, lighting your local tap water. Now, the problem with water is not a surprise for officials. Last year, Jackson residents were complaining of low water pressure and of sewage floating in the streets. In August of 2022, heavy rain caused flash flooding, and officials said the floods caused the pumps at the main water treatment plant to fail. Now, officials were forced to distribute bottled water and tanker trucks for over 180,000 residents. So what is happening in places like Jackson, Mississippi, where people simply have no clean water?
Well, from what I've read and heard, the problem in Jackson, their problems began basically the same way Flint's did, with a population decline that led to budget cuts. So how do you pay the bills on infrastructure that was originally designed to serve a larger tax base? Naturally, they have to cut corners somewhere. Now, I've heard this was caused or influenced by racism, that wealthier white people moved away over the years because they didn't want to live in a majority black city. I don't know all the facts about that, but I do know that public access to water should not be allowed to lapse anywhere in the country, ever. The United Nations actually recognizes access to safe drinking water as a human right. So if this happens anywhere, it is a serious embarrassment to our country.
Last year, community leaders had asked the state for $47 million in order to repair water and sewer facilities. But the state only gave them $3 million. In December 2021, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency announced that according to the Infrastructure Law of 2022, Mississippi will receive close to $75 million for water infrastructure. But the mayor says they need $2 billion for the problems to be solved.
Situation in Jackson is analogous to many places in the United States. And it's really part of this overall, you know, people will say, well, the water infrastructure hasn't been updated, not merely water infrastructure, but infrastructure in general. It's sort of the bearing fruit of a policy of deindustrialization and the denigration of the physical economy, which has been in the process that's been going on for decades. It's not anything isolated just to Jackson. It's a society-wide crisis. And when it affects something as essential as water, of course, people are going to notice. I mean, it's not, whether it be bridges or roads or the railways that are in complete dysfunction, that's maybe easier for some people to ignore. But if you're having, you know, brown or black liquid coming out of your tap, that's pretty hard to ignore.
Just like almost everything else in the United States, this water crisis also has racism written all over it. Jackson's population is about 82% African American and 17% white. The city's mayor, Lumumba, had said a lack of political will and years of neglect on a national level has prevented Jackson from getting the help it needs to fix its water and sewer crisis.
This has been something we've been crying out for more than 2 years, saying that it's not a matter of if our systems will fail, but a matter of when our systems will fail. I have described Jackson as the poster child of the infrastructure challenges that we see in this country. And so this is something that, when the state joined me and shared that they would be bringing in resources, bringing in a team to support us, we welcome that with open arms because we've been saying that we needed the support. We've been saying that we need resources. And so this is a matter of human rights. This is a matter of deferred maintenance that has happened over decades, a lack of investment in capital improvements, and quite possibly, quite honestly, probably more than $1 billion worth of challenges that have to go into our water distribution system.
Now, during the two decades between 1980 and 2000, the population of Jackson changed from majority white to majority black. After the state was forced to desegregate schools, the white population put up a fight for over a decade and then moved out of the city in what some have called the white flight. Now, when the white population left en masse, Jackson's tax base was severely cut and investment in infrastructure severely reduced.
Well, again, they get caught holding the bag when they have to cut their budgets for whatever reason. A wealthier community is probably going to have a better bond rating and be able to borrow its way out of hard times. A poorer community just has to suck it up and spend less, even if that means worse services, including water. And it is worth repeating that this is a national embarrassment for our wealthy country, though we're not the only country where it happens. Access to safe drinking water is an internationally recognized human right, and we're failing to adequately protect it. Now, I wouldn't call myself socialist, and though there's a current of what's called eco-socialism in my party, the Green Party, that current is about decentralized grassroots economics, not a centralized state-run thing. We want small businesses and empowered communities. And ideally, nobody should need help from a centralized authority because that tends to centralize political power, too, which undermines the whole purpose of human rights. I don't have all the answers, but I am trying to ask the right questions. And I think that clearly our system just isn't working for us and needs some fundamental changes.
Head of the Environmental Protection Agency has said in Jackson, there has been a difference in lack of investment to water infrastructure in this country for decades, but especially in our black and brown communities. It's imperative that we correct this long-standing issue, like the aftermath of the lead contamination in Flint, Michigan's water system in 2014. The people of Jackson say they cannot trust the officials.
You know, Jackson, like many cities across the country, has had a fragile water system. It's our job to ensure that every person in this country has access to clean drinking water. So some of these structural issues actually existed prior to. I don't think that's a secret. I think when we look at this flooding situation, and I think as we look at increasing evidence of climate change and intense storms, we're going to see even more stresses on these fragile water systems. So we do have to walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to be able to look at the repairs that need to take place on a normal basis, but we also have to begin to make investments to ensure that not only we build functioning water systems, but that they are more resilient to the types of storms that we're seeing as we move forward.
One Jackson resident says she receives assistance from the Federal Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, but has to use most of the money from it to buy bottled water. She explains that she spends about $200 a month on bottled water alone. Tate Reeves, the governor of Mississippi, has called the ongoing water crisis in Jackson an immediate health threat. City is run by majority black Democrats, while the state is being run by white Republicans.
Well, I mean, the people in charge here view most of the population as being completely redundant and not worth investing anything into. It's symptomatic of a broader, the issues with water are symptomatic of just an entire, like a broader, entire orientation that the ruling class has, whether it be water, education, housing, food. They seem completely disinterested in the well-being of particularly poor people who they would consider to be essentially useless eaters from their point of view. In their mind, there are already too many of us anyhow, so the idea that they would do much to allow us to continue to propagate and flourish is an anathema to people who view who don't value human life in general. And of course, there are issues of racism that play a role in being able to justify this orientation towards the masses. As I mentioned earlier, I live in Detroit, an 85% black city. So, you know, you could, it's easier to play off certain segments of the population against each other on the basis of their race, even if they share a class, the same class position.
Also, for the second year in a row, the states of Nevada and Arizona are facing cuts in the volume of water they can draw from the Colorado River. Extreme drought has hit western United States, causing water levels at Lake Mead, the country's largest man-made reservoir, to drop further. The lake, at its current state, is not even a quarter full. Climate change and overconsumption are said to be the reasons behind the drop in water levels.
Well, in terms of area, the droughts are extreme. The last federal report said the drought area shrank in the West from about 89% of the western land to 73%. So good news, but still pretty high. From what I know, the droughts affect agriculture more than drinking water, at least here in my state of Oregon. It is also strongly associated with the wildfire season. The Pacific Northwest is covered with forests that burn every year, and how much burns is largely dependent on how much rain falls and when. This year, we haven't had a bad fire season, but in 2020, we had one of the worst I've ever seen, and I've been here about 30 years. Now, I hear a lot of stories from California when their droughts are, where their droughts are pretty bad, and they have to restrict water use. But again, we're talking about a country where people use their potable water, their drinking water, on their lawns and to fill swimming pools. So there is a lot of room for cuts in wealthier areas. The United States is overall an extremely wealthy country, even if that wealth is distributed extremely unevenly.
Lake Mead in Nevada and Arizona and Lake Powell in Utah and Arizona are at their lowest levels ever. They're now set at dead pool status, which means the water level is so low it is no longer able to flow downstream and power the hydroelectric power stations. So this has caused Americans in the West to face power and water shortage.
The droughts are significant, or at least water shortages. Places like Las Vegas, for example, recently have begun the process of doing away with grass lawns, which people can say that's either good or bad. You know, I don't know. I don't live there. But there have been record. I mean, the reservoir that cities like Las Vegas draw their water from are continually, I'm hearing, it seems like each year it's at a new record low, the available water. And places like California, other places in the West in particular, are the people who are experiencing water, actual water shortages.
Climate issues, along with serious concerns about the country's infrastructure, have raised alarms about the government's expenditure on the military. The country has around 750 military bases around the world. While it cannot provide the basic needs of the people of Jackson, Mississippi, even a small cut of the Pentagon's budget could solve the infrastructure problems of several towns and cities.
Well, it has, but first, it's always hard to tell what is really going to happen because Congress is so two-faced about everything, including giving their bills propaganda names. This one was called the Build Back Better Bill after Joe Biden's campaign slogan, Build Back Better, which, in my opinion, is one of the lamest slogans ever. You got to understand how Congress works. You start writing a bill for $1 trillion in spending. That is more than the net worth of a lot of countries in this world. So there is a lot of room for corruption. Everyone lines up to get a slice of the pie to bring back to their district or state and maybe enrich themselves personally in the process. Now, that being said, yes, the bill does provide funding for publicly owned water systems, and that is a good thing. We'll see.
Now, the amount of money that Americans have spent on their government's ambitious and ridiculously interventionist foreign policy and military expands every single year. And now U.S. taxpayers are forced to pay for a war in Ukraine as well. The U.S. spends more on national security than the next six or seven countries combined. money that could have been spent so the poor people of places like Jackson, Mississippi, could have access to clean drinking water. And now let's see what Abbas Motarim has prepared for us this week.
Peace, and welcome back to Power to the People. In this segment today, we is going to take a look at the water crisis in America, and specifically look at two black cities, Flint, Michigan, and Jackson, Mississippi. First and foremost, when we talk about water, we must understand that water itself is given from God, and it's a universal human right. Yet under American capitalist imperialism, it is privatized for mass profits for the elite. This means that colonized black communities and poor communities across the so-called United States, by default, are exploited. So it's to no surprise that black communities across this nation suffer from not having access to clean water. Yet there's never a concern for white and affluent communities. If we look at cities like Jackson, Mississippi and Flint, Michigan, these predominantly black cities, they currently do not have universal access to public water. Residents in Jackson, they don't have access to drinking water, and they are literally unable to even take showers safely due to toxic water. And the government, they've told residents to keep their mouth closed when they shower, as if the water itself isn't toxic to the skin too. In Flint, Michigan, there was literally lead in the water, and it's estimated that up to 12,000 children was exposed to lead. And while many people think that the Flint water crisis has ended, it didn't, and the people of Flint are still suffering. And the federal government, they have done little to nothing. During the Flint crisis, Obama, the first black president, he traveled to Flint and he did a publicity stunt and said that the water is fine to drink and acted as if he took a sip of the water himself.
It is. There you go. You know, generally I have not been doing stunts here, but you know. And this used a filter. You know, the water around this table, you know, it was Flint water that was filtered, and it just confirms what we know scientifically, which is that if you're using a filter, if you're installing it, then Flint water at this point is drinkable.
Obama, he would literally rather drop drone strikes on Africans than spend money to fix Flint's water system. And the terrible part about these water crises is that they are predictable. They are literally a byproduct of neoliberalism and imperialism. The Vice President of America, Kamala Harris, she once said that the next wars will be fought over water.
You know, for years and generations, wars have been fought over oil. In a short matter of time, they will be fought over water.
And even before her presidency, her vice presidency rather, the black community, or rather the black colony inside the so-called USA, there was already a victim to these wars that she was talking about. We must understand that this is nothing short of genocidal practices towards black people. And recently, the In the Spirit of Mandela Coalition, they charged the United States with genocide and they was found guilty. And one of these charges was environmental racism. And it's very clear that this environmental racism is producing genocide against black people. Though there have been these genocidal conditions, the people, they have always been rising up. Groups like Cooperation Jackson in Mississippi, they have been an essential and vital resource for the people during this crisis. They have been providing water to the community for free, while the government, they sit back and do nothing but collect checks. This shows us that we must become our own liberators. We must provide for ourselves and build decolonization programs that support the process of building revolution, while also taking care of our people's immediate material needs under American settler colonialism. This is Power to the People.
And that was our show, everyone. I'm your host, Daniel Arya. Do join us again next time for another episode of We the People. Bye-bye for now.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. السلام عليكم ورحمة الله.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
This is Taqwa, Thursday the 2nd of Ramadan, 1394, 19 September, 1974. 700 million Muslims are sitting just waiting for God's mercy to come to them and allowing people to violate their dignity, trample upon their faith, and take everything they have. Are you sitting hoping for God's mercy in these circumstances? In that case, you may as well get comfortable. Allah says, and obey Allah and the Apostle, so that you may be granted His mercy. What does it mean to obey Allah? In what are we supposed to obey Him? To convey all of the divine duties and proofs to the enemy, to do our duty, whatever that may be. Allah says in the Quran that the truly faithful are those who, when any dispute occurs between them, they refer it to God's messenger, and when the messenger judges between them, they do not find in their hearts any dissent to your verdict, and submit to it in full submission. This is the mark of a true believer. If there were a people or a nation, if there were a society that obeyed God in this manner, that is when His limitless mercy and kindness would surround them. That is when these people would attain dignity. That is when these people would grow to be fully fledged human beings. That is when they would be freed from the chains and fetters that bind them. That is when they would receive God's mercy.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
So, and obey Allah and the Apostle, so that you may be granted His mercy. And hasten towards your Lord's forgiveness and a paradise as vast as the heavens and the earth, prepared for the God-weary. The Quran, Surah 3, verse 133. Here we see that Allah not only gives one example of taqwa, but also describes a consequence of it. Then He mentions further examples of what constitutes taqwa below. In this world, many are willing to race each other to gain ownership of a plot of land, which is only a bit of water and dirt, and they are ready to overtake others for this. They are ready to give all of their strength and energy so that, as well as obtaining the land, they are able to make a living from it. Perhaps to run a shop, to gain the ear of a powerful person, or to manage a company somewhere in the world, to gain whatever material advantages they can. For these things, you are ready to race, to leave others behind, even if it means trampling on all virtues and dignities in the process.
Allah, I wanna thank you. I wanna thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Alami, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
The World Bank, in its latest report on Afghanistan, has said that global food and energy prices continue to put pressure on basic household prices in the crisis-stricken country. At the same time, rising inflation and slow recovery in nominal wages have decreased the people's ability to buy basic goods.
Today, we witness people have lesser purchasing power. Previously, a middle-class household used to pay nearly $200 to buy multiple goods, but today they only ask for very basic necessities like oil and flour. You know, the prices are increasing. In addition, the banking crisis and sanctions have affected the prices and business in the market.
The World Bank report has confirmed that since June 2022, Afghanistan's currency has depreciated slightly against the U.S. dollar, while the prices of basic food and fuel items continue the upward trend. Abdullah Rizayi, who has been working as a shoemaker for almost half of his life, says he had never experienced such economic conditions before.
In the past years, I used to make sufficient income from this job. Currently, I'm not only receiving fewer customers, but the money that I earn has lost its value. I used to make 300 Afghanis per day, but nowadays I hardly can make 50, which is the price of 5 loaves of bread. Sometimes I feel ashamed when I look at my children.
In the meantime, widespread joblessness is leaving many Afghan families without a solution to make ends meet.
We have had a job once or twice a week in the spring and summer. I wonder why we should do it in the winter when there is no job to do. People are struggling with hunger and difficulties. Some have their own houses, but they should pay for the house rent too. This year, I fell short of paying the bills, and now I am in debt.
This comes as the World Food Program has warned that Afghanistan is facing its most serious risk of famine in 20 years. The UN body has asked for $1.1 billion life-saving assistance for 18 million people across Afghanistan. The ripple effects of the US sanctions and freezing of billions of dollars in Afghans' assets are pushing up inflation in Afghanistan. People here are calling for the release of assets and more international funding to the country. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Polls show that a divided Congress appears all but assured 6 weeks before the federal legislative vote in the United States, which would also ensure continued political division and stagnation. The Democrat-led inquiry over protests which alleged election fraud in 2020 continue to plod on, but polls show they have had essentially no effect on changing voters' opinions. While longtime Democratic leader Nancy Pelosi looks certain to be forced out of power in November, the top level of Republican leadership looks likely to add more so-called Trumpists, reflecting the enduring influence of ex-President Donald Trump. The biggest unofficial political